Welcome back to the Derek Loudermilk Show. This is episode 385 with Aaron Abke. Today, our guest is one of our most popular of all time, and he's back on the show, Aaron Abke. And today, we are going to cover a range of topics from how Jesus performed his miracles to why higher density or higher dimensional beings are choosing to incarnate on Earth at this time. We're going to talk about the tragic history of the civilization and the planet Maldek, which was basically exploded, destroyed in a war, which is now the asteroid belt in our solar system. We're going to talk about how language and money are spiritual mechanisms of control on Earth, and we'll get into the difference between the legal system and law and how these zombie entities are set up to essentially trick people into a debt slavery system. There's a lot here. So let's just get right into it. Here is the interview with Aaron Abke. Aaron, good to see you again.
Good to be back, brother. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So Christmas is coming up, and someone was doing a channeling. I don't know if you know Tyler Ellison. He channels Ryo. Uh-uh. And someone asked a question, why was Jesus able to manifest things so quickly? And he was talking about one thing that Jesus did was he, well, two things. He was in alignment with what the universe already wanted to manifest. And so it was just kind of like, it was much easier for him to do because it was not ego-based. But the other thing they said was that he would always issue commands. He would speak out loud, like, now you will walk, and the guy would stand up and walk. Yeah. Wondered if you want to comment on any more about what you understand about how Jesus did his miracles or where he got his power from, you know?
Yeah. Super fun question to jam on. Well, so the way I've been coming into this understanding myself through really heavily studying Christian Science and New Thought and Science of Mind, which kind of go into this area of the miraculous, especially, is that God is like law, principle, in that it will demonstrate itself infallibly when it's applied correctly. And so a miracle, we could say, a healing would be like someone applying the law of God correctly. So obviously Jesus was performing these miracles, as does any great sage or avatar, from his own level of deep realization of his God awareness. So I think to an extent, we have to raise our consciousness to a certain level before miracles like that become possible for us. Because, for example, in the Law of One, Ra talks about how consciousness works just like an electron or a proton or a quantum particle, in that we know that a quantum particle cannot do work, which is a physics term, right? Unless that particle has a charge. So without a charge, there's no ability to do work in physics. And Ra says the same principle applies in consciousness, that consciousness has to have a positive or a negative charge before it can do work, before it can actually apply itself metaphysically to reality. And so our charge that we're talking about is what Ra calls polarization, right? Positive or negative. And so on the positive polarity, all the different powers that would come with unity and oneness, such as physical healing, such as bilocation, teleportation, we could go on and on. All of those powers are possible on the positive polarity, as it is the polarity of the awareness of oneness, that all the universe is connected, like the quantum field, right? There's actually no separation at all. The negative polarity is the path of separation. So negatively polarized powers look very different in most regards to positively polarized powers. The negative path is the path of separation, which sees the universe as something that should be divided and conquered, right? So the powers that a negatively polarized entity in the universe would possess are like what we consider black magic, powers of deception and mind control and manipulation. The negative path thrives on taking energy from a host, because the negative path in itself doesn't have any power. It is magnetic, right? So it is inward pulling, it's absorption, it has to take in order to have. Whereas the positive polarity is radiation, outward moving. It has all the power within because of its awareness of oneness. So Christ was performing these positively polarized miracles all the time because he had gained a certain charge in consciousness to be able to apply those laws and principles of reality. So for me, it's more like, am I abiding in the awareness of the Creator in all things? When I, you know, like I did this growing up in church all the time, physical healing and stuff. When I'm laying hands on someone and praying for them, am I actually aware in that moment that only God exists in this body I'm touching? Which means ultimately, in reality, there is no sickness in this body. There is no disease, no discord or disharmony of any kind, because God is the law of perfect health, perfect wholeness, eternal life, right? So in the Course in Miracles, Jesus says, I raised the dead by knowing that life is an eternal principle. So Jesus somehow was able to apply that knowing in a quantum way through the mind, through consciousness, such that the particles in the person's body have to obey that realization. Or we could say the energy that Christ was conducting through his charge in that moment, his awareness of the Creator, actually helps to remind the cells, the nerves in the body he's healing, that they are one and that there is no sickness. And so those cells can come back into alignment, right? This is kind of the way that Ra explains physical healing in the Law of One. Ra says that when we gain a certain charge of fourth density consciousness, where the heart chakra is now open, the heart chakra is the green ray, which is the energy center that performs healing. So Ra actually says the energy of our green ray rotates clockwise around the body. So it moves from, they say, from the right arm down to the right leg, right foot, left foot, back up to the left arm, around the head, and back to the right shoulder. So literally like a clock like this. Hmm. And it spirals like 2 or 3 times per second, I think. And as we, like, let's say, lay hands on someone to apply healing, that green ray energy that's moving around our energy field begins to scan their energy field, and it finds distortions. And Ra says, based on the intention in the mind and where your hand is actually being applied to the body, the green ray energy will follow the intention and the instruction you're giving. And it will then offer the other person an opportunity for reconfiguration. But Ra says the caveat is the person receiving your green ray energy has to receive it and be open to it and accept it. Because everything on the positive polarity has to come through free will and consent and, you know, truth and integrity. So it takes two. And really, the healer doesn't actually heal the person. The person who's getting healed actually heals themselves just by opening themselves to that energy and allowing it to take place in you. So kind of a lot of different veins I just covered, but that's kind of my current understanding of how the process of healing happens.
That's amazing. And when you personally are putting hands on someone and you're talking about knowing, the knowing that everything is one, like what does that feel like? It's because I'm guessing it's more than an intellectual, just sort of like, yeah, for sure. Everything is one. Sounds good. Let's do some healing.
Yes.
What does it feel like?
Yes. Yeah. It's not conceptual. That's the big point. It's not just like, oh, I understand mentally that all is one. That's not the charge in consciousness. But actually, the truth of oneness is beyond the mind, right? It's earlier than the mind. It is reality itself. Reality is one, whether the mind knows it or not. And so when we connect to that knowing, that principle of oneness, we actually feel it happening within us. We feel it in our being, sort of like, I could say, a deep, overwhelming reassurance or assurance that all is one. So we actually feel peace come over us. We, for example, don't actually perceive that there is an illness to be healed in front of us. And here's what I mean by that. I believe that illness is kind of like a shadow being cast into the body from the mind, meaning that all sickness is ultimately in the mind. Based on what? Based on our essential belief that there is separation from source, that we are separate from source. And that goes a lot deeper than any of us realize, right? If you're even perceiving a physical or material universe at all, you believe you're separate from source. Because there's not two different universes, right? A physical universe and a spiritual universe. And we don't leave the physical universe and go to the spiritual one to get our problems solved and our body healed, right? There is really no physical body. The body is pure spirit, but our mind sees it as physical, something that's separate from the spirit, right? From eternal truth. And it's not. It is the creator appearing, but the mind makes it a physical object and then separates it. And then now sickness and disease and discord can manifest in that body. And so Jesus was so aware that only God exists and God is perfect health, perfect wholeness, perfect abundance. So there can't actually be sickness here. But in the same way that when we dream at night, we can have all kinds of experiences that seem to be real. If we believe we're separate, and especially if we believe we're unworthy of love or we're lacking acceptance or we're afraid or we have all these different distortions in the mind, they will have to manifest in the body at some point. And so it's kind of like a shadow, right? If I have a tree and it's obstructing some light, there's going to be a shadow of a tree on the ground. Mm-hmm. And we look at the shadow and we can't get rid of the shadow by trying to remove the shadow, right? Because it's just a projection coming from the light and the tree that's obscuring the light. So we have to go cut down the tree, the physical tree, if we want the shadow to be removed, right, from the ground. No matter how much we try to remove the shadow, it will never move because it doesn't exist really, right? It's an illusion. So it's like, what if sickness is like that? What if sickness is being projected like a shadow from a belief in the mind that says there is separation from source? There is a lack of health present here and now. That's like a tree in the mind, an object that blocks the light of truth from getting into the body. And so then some kind of sickness happens, right? That's what I mean when I say that it's an illusion, in that really the whole universe is an illusion because it's impermanent. It's constantly changing. Whatever appears will disappear, which means it's not actually real in the eternal sense. The truth of God is real and eternal because it doesn't change and it always exists. And those truths are health, wholeness, perfection, abundance, and so forth. So it's like, to the degree my awareness is tuned in to eternal truth, I can apply that eternal truth and correct those misperceptions that happen in the mind. This is why so many people don't get healed until they heal their traumas, right? Trauma work is a huge element of physical healing because those deeply ingrained beliefs we form through our traumas, I'm a victim, I was abused, no one loves me, blah, blah, blah. They become like those trees that block the light of truth, those objects in the mind that cast shadows into the body. So that's what, you know, science of mind, how science of mind kind of sees it. And it's like the laws of math, for example, are eternal and unchanging. So if I have an equation like 5 + 5 = 9, I can't pray and ask the gods of math to make my equation true. You know what I mean? It's not true. All I can do is come into the right understanding of the laws of math, which say that 5 + 5 = 10. So like the mistake we make, and it might seem subtle, but it's huge when it comes to metaphysical laws, is it's just like law of attraction, right? We always say law of attraction. If you're chasing something, if you're begging for it and asking for it so much, you're kind of implying you don't have it. To the universe's language, you're saying, I really am lacking a special relationship, so please give me a relationship. You're really just saying, I don't have a relationship right now. And so that's what you tend to attract. And so we just say, like, get into the field of consciousness and imagine what a perfect relationship feels like, and just get turned on by that visualization and feel the joy of it. And then you're asking for it from the universe's point of view. That's what we're saying with physical healing as well, is that if I believe there's really a physical sickness here, meaning reality has actually been damaged in this person's body, and I'm asking for reality to be healed, well, reality can't be damaged, right? That's an illusion in the mind. So I can't make a physical sickness real in my mind and then try to heal it. I have to understand the physical sickness isn't real. It's an illusion in the mind only. And from that level, healing can happen. A correction from that level can happen. And that's the big mistake most people make when they perform Reiki or pray for healing, is that they think they're really asking the universe to heal a physical problem. And there actually isn't one. There's just the cells in the body that respond to these negative beliefs of the mind. And so when we correct those beliefs, the sickness is corrected in like form.
I'm realizing that I think I have a hack or like a halfway there point with Reiki, at least. So what I find is most effective when I'm doing Reiki is like, if I intend for them to, you know, be whole again, and then distract myself, which is like have a conversation, and then like, it's, you know, the energy is moving on its own, but I take my focus off of it. Like I do it on purpose so that I'm not thinking about like me putting energy into a person. And that's when it seems to actually have success.
Yes. That's another huge principle of healing, is to get your mind off the problem. Stop focusing on the problem at hand, because you're giving it more reality when you do that. So the analogy I give for this is if we're in a 7-story building, and let's say that floor one represents like hell on earth, the worst imaginable reality. Floor 7 represents heaven on earth, the most divine possible reality. Let's say that we're on floor 3, right? Where things are pretty dark down here. It's not so great. Well, if I want to get to floor 7, or if I want to experience floor 7, what I can't do is to ask floor 7 or to make floor 7 come down to floor 3. Floor 7's not on floor 3. It's a different floor, right? So I have to abandon floor 3, get into the elevator of awareness, and rise to where floor 7 is. So again, coming back to, how aware are you of the perfection of the Creator here and now? How aware are you that there is no absence of good in this present moment? Only what you believe, right? Only what you think. And so when I rise to floor 7, then I experience floor 7. And the harmony and the health and the wholeness of floor 7 will start to demonstrate itself in my reality.
You're so full of wonderful analogies and explanations. I feel like I hit a home run asking you about that already. You mentioned Christian Science. My ex was a Christian Scientist, and she told me sort of the first healing story that I ever heard was she worked at a summer camp, and one of the horses like fell in a ravine and broke its leg, and they were sort of far away from camp, and they're like, oh no. And they're like, whoa, let's just heal the horse. So they all gathered around and unbroke the leg and rode back to camp. And I was like,
amazing.
Really? She was like, yeah, we all saw it. We all did it. And I was like, well, I really want to see that. First of all, you know, I was super curious. But so there was a lot of, is what you're talking about, you know, what I think it was Mary Baker Eddy who started that track. Is that sort of what she realized and is teaching through Christian Science? Is that what it's based on?
Yeah, Mary Baker Eddy, I believe the story goes that she had a big accident one day. She slipped and fell on some ice when she was walking with friends during the winter. And like, I think she like cracked a bunch of ribs in her back or something, and really messed her back up from the fall. So she was bedridden in all kinds of agony. And the doctors were like, oh man, you might be in bad shape. Like you might never walk right again, you know? So she's laying in bed and she's like, bring me my Bible. And someone brings her the Bible, and she opens it, and she goes to a certain verse. I don't remember what the verse is or what it says, but the verse in her, it ignited something in her that made her go, wait a minute, do I really believe that there's an absence of health here? Well, if I believe there's an absence of health in my body, then I have to believe that there's an absence of God in my body. And is that true? Can there be an absence of God anywhere in the universe? I don't believe that. And so this realization was ignited in her to such an extent that it lifted her consciousness to that realization. She felt this joy at the understanding. And that was, I think, the charge we talked about earlier, is that whenever we connect to divine truth, it is felt as bliss, joy, release, expansion, right? So she felt that, and instantly her back, the bones, whatever, came back together. She was healed, and she jumps out of bed celebrating. And her family's like, oh my God, what are you doing? Get back in bed. You're going to hurt yourself. And she's like, oh, I'm healed. I have no pain. And that moment changed her forever. And I mean, she was like in her 50s or 60s when that happened. And she went, I've got to teach this. I just experienced a living example of it. I got to teach this. So she opened the First Church of Christian Science sometime later and started teaching these principles of divine healing. And what's interesting to me is the correlations again with the Law of One of what Ra says. Ra is asked in one passage about what third density planets were like eons ago, maybe universes ago, before the concept of the veil of forgetting was put around third density planets. So for those not familiar, Ra says that this density we're in, the third density out of all seven in the universe, is the only density that has a veil of forgetting, meaning we incarnate here and we don't remember our past lives. We don't remember the laws of the universe and that we're eternal and all that stuff. We just wake up in a human body and think that's all we are, and we just go along our journey, right? Well, Ra says before that idea was conceived in the universe to block out the memory of souls incarnating here, then third density souls had full memory of all their past lives, just like every other density does. Full knowledge of how the universe works and that all is one, all is the creator. And so Ra says when third density beings back then were injured, the body would respond with pain, just like it would now, only to alert their attention to where the problem was. Let's say I break my arm. Oh, my arm hurts. Oh, the arm's broken. And then they could just apply healing to it and heal the arm. Or if they burn themselves or something, they could just cut off the pain mentally. Now that the message is received, oops, I burned myself. I'll take care of this wound. I don't need the pain anymore because I know there's a wound here. They just cut off the pain mentally. So that's possible for us in third density because that was the norm in third density before the veil of forgetting happened. It's that we're under this veil again of separation, that we think we're separate. We think there's such a thing as the absence of God, aka health, right? And so we live under this delusion and we co-create a reality of sickness on this planet. And so I think that to a large extent, disease and sickness are inevitable for us in third density because all of humanity is like one single mind. Ra calls it the social memory complex. So the energy field on our planet is whatever the collective believes ultimately, right? So when you have 7.5 billion people on the planet who genuinely believe that sickness and disease is a normal, inevitable part of human life, it's unavoidable, you know, then it co-creates a reality where disease manifests in the collective because our energy is creating it. But as we continue to evolve and we understand where health really comes from, which is that health is inherent to our being, and the less we separate ourselves from the universe, we naturally are healthy and vibrant and radiant, then I think eventually humanity will outlive what we call sickness and disease, and we'll probably live. I mean, Ra says the original lifespan of a third density being was 1,000 years. Like, we're supposed to be living about 1,000 years in these bodies, which is still a very short lifespan in the grand scheme of all the seven densities, but way longer than we're used to, right? We're living like 10 times shorter than what we're intended to live on this planet, which tells you how distorted and heavy and negative our collective consciousness on this planet is right now.
Actually, I was thinking statistically about if we weren't limited by disease, then pretty much everyone would die of like freak accidents. And so you have like a freak car crash or a freak, you know, meteor hitting your house or whatever it might be, like, and it averages out to 1,000 years. So it's like the lifespan is just limited by, you know, the odds of mortal injury, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a big factor in it. I also think a lot of the injuries that would kill someone at that level of consciousness wouldn't actually be fatal, but we could heal them, or other people could heal the body. Like raising the dead is also a miracle that people perform, you know, Jesus performed many times, and is possible for us as well. I think the way that death would work in third density is, you know, this density is not supposed to be a very long density. The third density is pretty much just for the purpose of choosing your polarity, right? Do you want to be a positive or negatively polarized soul? And so your soul incarnates here however many lifetimes it takes before it decides which of those two polarities it prefers. And then once you choose your polarity, you graduate to the fourth density, where the lifespan is like 90,000 years per incarnation. And it's like a 30 million year lifespan overall. So you upgrade to a much higher vibrational body that is basically impossible to kill for all intents and purposes, because it's able to heal and rejuvenate. So I think that in the best case scenario for a third density lifetime, let's say as evolved as it could possibly get, we would live about 1,000 years. And when it was time for our incarnation to retire, because our soul kind of knows, like, I don't want or need to spend forever as a human, because this is a very limited density compared to what's available. Like, we're going to be a light body in someday where we're pure energy, you know? So this physical meat suit's very limited and we're totally ready to move on. There comes a time in everyone's life where the soul knows, this is the end of my incarnation here, time to move on to the next one. And just like a lot of sages do, just kind of sit in meditation and just consciously exit their body. Like, there doesn't even need to be a disease necessarily, but we can just kind of know and feel like, my time here is done. I've learned all the lessons that this realm offers me. I've experienced everything I need to experience here. I'm ready to move on. And then you kind of close your eyes and exit the body.
I just finished reading Autobiography of a Yogi, and he talks about this all the time. His guru, he's like, okay, I'm going to tell you when I'm going to die. It's going to be in about a month. And yep. Let's have a party beforehand. And then that day he just kind of like disappeared.
Yep.
You know? That's
how they all do it, man.
Speaking of, have you heard of this guy, Babaji? Who's mentioned
My
in that
avatar,
book?
Babaji.
Who is like pals with Jesus. Is that right? They're like from the same time period?
I'm sure they are. Yeah.
My understanding from that book is that they sort of made a deal. Jesus was like, I'll be the one to go to the other side and do my work. And Babaji was like, I'll just be immortal here and work from this side.
I was like, yeah. Do you remember the story in that book where Ma Avatar Babaji and a bunch of the devotees are up on the mountains in the Himalayas or whatever? And this guy runs up the mountain, because apparently people hike the Himalayas to find Babaji up there, because many people have had, even some gurus alive now have said that they've encountered Babaji in those mountains. If you climb high enough, people have these experiences where he appears and has a conversation with them. So this, many yogis would do that in those days. And this one guy is climbing up the mountain and sees their camp and runs up to them and prostrates at Babaji's feet and says, Master, I've traveled far and wide and I've hiked this mountain looking for you. And now I devote myself to you forever. Please take me as your disciple. And Babaji says, if you really want to be my disciple, throw yourself off this mountain. And so the guy gets up and runs off the mountain and falls to his death. And then Babaji tells his devotees, like, go grab his body and bring it up here. And so the devotees go down the mountain and grab his body and hike up the mountain with it and put it in front of Babaji, and then he raises him from the dead and says, okay, now you can be my disciple.
Yeah, super, super dramatic. And the test was like, if you actually believe that he's worth following, or
you got it.
Yeah. Wow. Do you think,
are you willing to die for this?
Do you think you could do that?
Good question. You can't really know the answer to that question unless you're in that moment, right?
Have you ever had a time where you've done something that you maybe previously didn't believe was possible, but then when it came time to do it, it was just like pretty straightforward?
Yes. I don't know about if it was easy though, but I have had things where when the moment arises, you know, your soul rises to the occasion in a way that you weren't sure that you had within you, right? I've experienced things spiritually speaking that I once struggled to believe were possible, and then to, like, healing, for example, and then to experience it firsthand like that kind of alters your perception permanently. Like, okay, now I have no way to doubt that this is possible. I have first evidence and experience of it. So now I have to adjust the way I live in reality according to this, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think partly that's what's underlying my fascination with superpowers. Like, I'm from Missouri, we call it the show me state, but there is something that, like, as soon as I sort of see it, then I will understand it's possible. And now it's like intellectually, I understand that, you know, bilocation is possible. Or so I was practicing, I was trying to spin one of these little psi wheels. Like, you put it on it's like a tinfoil wheel, and you put it on a point, and then you just try to get it to rotate with your mind, like very basic telekinesis.
Telekinesis, yeah.
And I got it to move like one time, and then I was like, oh, I get it. But I had to experience it in a way.
Mm-hmm. When I was like 23, I was just leaving. I was in the point of trying to leave my religion because I had outgrown a lot of the dogmatic beliefs, and I was expanding into like higher consciousness ideas and stuff. And there was a church called Bethel Church in Reading, which is a very famous church in the Christian world. They do all the kind of biggest worship albums and stuff. And I heard about these people that were like able to stick objects to the wall with their mind, starting with like quarters and pennies and dimes. And so I was like, oh, I want to try doing that. And so I would sit in front of my wall and just have like a quarter and just stick it on the wall and remove my finger, and it would just fall every single time for about 20 or 30 minutes. And then after 30 minutes, I'm doing this and I'm just like, no, it's going to stick. And I'm just watching, just like in a flow state, not even thinking like, oh no, it fell again. Oh no, it fell again. Just doing it, right? And then I put my finger away at one point, and the quarter stayed there for like 7 to 8 seconds on the wall and then fell. And I went, so I put it back and it fell like three more times right away. And then I put it back a fifth time and it stayed for 20 seconds. I went, oh my gosh. Put it a few more times, and then it stays permanently. I go to bed, wake up the next morning, still on the wall. And then I started sticking quarters and pennies to, because people are like, well, maybe some adhesive in the paint of the wall, you know?
Sure.
And like, quarters are pretty heavy, man. I don't think you could even do that with glue, but I would try to prove people wrong by sticking it on, you know, like really smooth wood on your cabinets, like glossy, shiny wood. Sticking on my cabinets. And then I finally did it on a marble fireplace. Like, what's slicker than that, right? And so once I was doing it with that, I started trying like spoons and other metal objects. And I got a spoon to stick to my wall. And I have pictures of all this on my phone, actually. I'll hold up some of them to the camera, see if you can see it. But that was one of those things that altered my perception of how reality works. And it's like, okay, so mind has a lot to do with reality. Clearly, I'm not exactly sure how or why this is working, but I taught many other people how to do it. This is a picture of the spoon.
That's amazing. This was like great prank material.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is my shoe on the ceiling?
I would stick quarters to like the corner of cabinets so that most of the quarter was hanging off. I got a big glare on my phone. Sorry. It's kind of hard to see. Can you see
okay,
that?
Okay. Yeah. Yep.
So like three quarters of the quarter is not touching anything.
Yeah. Interesting.
So it's like, so how do you explain that? It's a fun question to contemplate.
Interesting. So there's something, my hypothesis, there's something there about like the continued intention for it to happen.
Yep. which is why I always say to people, don't just pray once for your healing. Pray is the loose term I use, by the way, for applying the laws of consciousness in your awareness. You know what I mean? Like, remember that there's no such thing as sickness in reality. Apply the truth of wholeness in your awareness. We can call that prayer, let's say. We're not asking or beseeching an entity in the heavens to do something. We're trying to connect to a law that exists. But let's call it prayer for convenience sake. Don't just pray for your healing once and then be like, well, bummer, it didn't work. It's like, look, how many times have you looked at your body and said, let's say you have cancer, right? How many times have you looked at your body and said, oh, there's a tumor in me. I really am sick with cancer. You know, hundreds, thousands of times. So why do you think necessarily that you should be able to just look at it with a new perception once and it'll immediately obey? It may not. There may be so much negative energy created in your energy field from the constant thinking and perceiving that there's a disease in you that it's going to take some time for that charge to diminish, to depolarize. So it's like, just live from the truth of wholeness. Forget about the cancer. Say, no, there's no cancer present. Cancer doesn't exist. There's only a wrong belief in my mind that I'm separate from source. And I'm just going to correct that belief in my mind. I'm not separate. This body's not separate from health. There is an abundance of health in my body right now. And even what seems to be cancer is actually just health in disguise. I believe that. And as people just live from that place, they just, all of a sudden the cancer is gone one day. Like, that's more of a practical approach to a lot of healing. And yes, we can lay hands, you know, demonstrate a healing like that. That happens too. But let's not expect that it should always be that way. Because in my experience, it's not. Sometimes it takes 10 times of praying for something before it leaves. Really, what matters is that the healing happens, right? So it's like, are you committed to living from these eternal laws or not? Like, do you want to keep living in the dream world where there's separate bodies that are separate from source and they get sick and they die? Then you can live in that dream if you want. But if you want to awaken to reality, you have to discard and abandon those perceptions. And every time the mind creates them, you have to say, nope, that's not true. There isn't an absence of source. There isn't a disease in my body. Only health exists. Health, life is an eternal principle. And there's no absence of it. Like, you have to be committed to that to actually demonstrate a lot of these healings.
So let's say you are committed to the healing and everyone around you is committed to your sickness. And there's, like, you talked about us being a collective consciousness. So it's like two competing intentions. But it's your body. Are you going to be able to outcompete, like, if everyone around you is still thinking you're sick, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. The way I understand this and the way it resonates in me is true. I don't know if this is true, but this is what feels true in me, is that one person in God is a majority. One person in truth is a majority. And this would hold sway to what Ra says as well, talking about the difference between the positive and the negative polarity. Now, I know you're a big fan of David Hawkins, so we can use the Hawkins analogy of power versus force. We know how much more power the positive has versus the negative, right? The negative is force, the positive is power. And David Hawkins shows the calibrations, right? That one person, let's say, at a 500 level is counterbalancing the energy of 575,000 people, something like that, right? So it's like, whoa, that's a lot more power in that one person, more charge, right? So all disease, in a sense, really is a collective manifestation, meaning we live under a heavy energetic blanket on this planet of this belief that we're separate and disease exists and stuff. So, like, I don't actually think that, I'm not convinced that on this planet right now, we can live from a place where sickness or disease never happens to us. Maybe there is a level of God consciousness where that can happen. But, you know, many of the most famous sages who were at these incredibly high levels of consciousness, they got cancer and they got sick and died from disease. So I think to an extent, it's a collective manifestation. But I think that if you want to heal yourself, if your intention is to be healthy and whole, then you can always heal the diseases or sicknesses that manifest from the collective. I do believe that, because that's what the Law of One seems to say. And when you ask the question, well, why did Ramana Maharshi then die of cancer? Why didn't he just heal himself? My answer to that is, it's hard for us to comprehend this, but some of these gurus who are so deeply self-realized, like, they couldn't care less about the body. And they're so disinterested from, like, staying around here longer and, like, living a long life. Like, that's not on their radar. All that they are aware of is the self, is God. And I think at that level of consciousness, to live on a planet like this is kind of what we would feel if we were locked in an insane asylum with people in straitjackets talking to themselves. You know what I mean? Like, would you want to stay in that realm super long? Probably not, right? You'd probably be very welcoming of your exit from that realm. So my answer is, I don't think these gurus want to heal their bodies, not because they're suffering and it's like, oh, get me out of here. No, it's just like, I'm here to be of service as long as I'm here. I have no need or intention to elongate my lifespan more than is necessary. So if a disease forms in the body, then that's what the universe wants for me. And it's my time to exit. I'm totally welcoming of that. I have no resistance to death. And so they don't really have a desire to heal themselves the way that you or I might have, because we do want to be here for a long time and do all these things, right? An enlightened being like that usually doesn't have those same desires.
Going back to Autobiography of a Yogi, I feel like someone gets sick and then one of their disciples is like, I need you, don't go. And they're like, okay, since you asked, like, I won't, you know, I'll heal myself and stay around longer. You know, it's like, oh, I can be of service. Yeah. Sure, that sounds fine.
Yep. Yeah, sometimes that happens too, right?
I had a breakthrough recently, and this is that voice message that I think you didn't get to hear or like disappeared into the ether, but
it was weird.
My realization was service. I was thinking like service to self, service to other. And when I would thought of service to other, I would always think of people, of humans. Mm-hmm. And my breakthrough was like, that's service to the whole. That's like service to anything, you know? So it's like, you can go and, you know, just be present for a walk in the woods as a way of like being of service to other. And that really expanded right. My view of how that sort of positive polarity actually feels.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful, man. That's a beautiful realization, because you're very right. Even just to pick up trash, like I'll pick up trash around my neighborhood whenever I'm walking my dog or something. And it's just like, oh, I just want the earth to be clean, you know? And that's service to others, right? I'm serving the planet. It doesn't have to be a human being. It could be an animal. It could be just the planet itself. It could be the universe itself. Even just to send love to the universe and tell the universe you love it is you blessing the universe with your energy. And that's an act of service. So it's like, it all comes down to the fact that the positive polarity lives from the constant recognition and awareness. All is one. Only I exist. Everything is me in a different form. The tree is me. The person is me. The sky is me. The star is me. The planet is me. It's just me appearing as all these different things. And so I naturally want to bless myself in all these forms. I want my highest good in every form I see. That is the key to enlightenment, man. When you live from a place where you genuinely, sincerely, from the bottom of your heart, want the goodness and happiness and freedom of everyone you meet just as badly as you want it for yourself, that's enlightenment. That's the state of liberation, because at that point, there's nothing left you can suffer from. I don't want anything from anyone. I'm not looking for their approval. I don't need them to like me or do something for me. I just want them to be blessed. And it's like, when I live from that loving awareness, I'm just loving everyone, loving everything in my mind. That's joy. That's freedom. That's what we're all looking for, right? Is to live with love leading our consciousness. And so to the degree we think we're separate from each other, we'll create these judgments in our minds, and those judgments and divisions will obscure us from the awareness of love's presence here and now.
There was something that I just remembered from a little earlier in our conversation about, you know, being on a third density planet. I've heard a lot recently about star seeds and wanderers and perhaps higher density beings coming back to inhabit a human body. But you said, you know, third density is to decide on a polarity. And I'm assuming like some of these beings have already decided and they're coming back. Can you say like why a higher density being would choose to come back to third density if they've already decided their polarity?
Yeah. Yeah. Third density is the only density of the seven where you can, what it's called, wander into. You can become a wanderer in third density. And that's because it's, again, the only density with that veil of forgetting. So the main purpose of wandering, there's two basic reasons why a soul would wander back to the third density, meaning to choose their next incarnation as a third density being versus a sixth or whatever density they're at, is because they want to take advantage of the enormous amount of catalyst here and learning opportunities here, because this is the only density with an equal amount of light and dark polarity in it. When you come here, you experience an equal proportion of positive and negative. Every other density, fourth through seventh, is locked into one polarity, basically, right? You're polarized one way or the other. Well, in third density, you can experience both, which means there's a ton of lessons the soul can learn here. Ra actually says in one passage that the third density is 100 times more difficult than the fourth density in terms of the intensity of the catalyst you experience. So a soul will, what's that?
I believe it.
Yeah, not hard to believe, right? Let's say a soul is trying to learn a really tough lesson about how to balance wisdom with love. They can do that in their native density, but they already know everything. Like, they remember their past lives. They understand the laws of the universe. So there's not a lot of polarization they can gain in their native density. It takes a long time to progress. In the same way that if I'm trying to learn how to play poker, for example, if I only ever play poker, what do they call it? A simulated game where, you know, when you're teaching someone how to play poker, you'll have like three or four of your buddies at a table and you walk them through the game and here's how it works. And you're always showing them your cards and they know everyone's cards. And then you tell them, okay, so next you'll probably want to play that two of hearts on this turn because we have these cards. It's like, okay, that will teach them the basics. But like, how much can they really learn how to play poker well when you're only teaching them like that, right? At a certain point, you got to shut those things off and play by the real rules, which is you don't get to know anybody's hand and you don't get to know anything about what we're doing. You have to play the game in your own mind now and see how you fare. Well, you become a really good poker player when you play like that, right? That's the third density with the veil of forgetting. You forget the rules you're playing under. You forget where you come from, why you're here. And you just have to grapple with the present moment of like, what do I feel in this moment? What am I struggling with? How do I meet this pain with love? And that gives the soul a lot more charge, a lot more polarity. So there's a risk reward for higher density beings to wandering. The reward is they can gain a lot more polarity in a much shorter period of time by coming here, where the lessons are super intense and super consequential, right? But the risk is that they get karmically involved here and they make a few mistakes where they have to reincarnate a few more times to correct those mistakes. Like if they end up murdering someone on accident or whatever, like in a car crash, their soul is going to feel so much remorse from that they're going to have to come back and karmically make recompense somehow. So there's a risk reward there. But the second reason souls will incarnate into third density is during a graduation period where that planet is eligible for the next density and it's not quite tipped to the positive yet, meaning there's a chance it can go to the negative. So positively polarized souls who are ready to incarnate, they can also be of service by choosing to undergo a human lifetime to bring their higher vibration, their higher level of consciousness to the planet and raise the planet's vibration and then hope to kind of tip the scales to that positive polarity. So that's another way a soul can gain a lot of polarity by being of great service, right? It's a really great act of self-sacrifice to say, you know what? I was about to go have a beautiful fifth density incarnation, but I saw that there's a struggling planet over here called Earth that might go negative, and a lot of souls are going to suffer if it goes negative. So I'm going to put that fifth density incarnation on hold, and I'm going to go back to third density where shit gets real, and it's going to be not a very easy lifetime. I'm going to have to deal with a lot of pain, right? They'll choose to do that for the planet's benefit.
I'm guessing because that would involve being of service that a negatively polarized being wouldn't do the same thing to counterbalance it.
Yes. Ross says that negative beings are, it's very rare that a negative being wanders back into third density once they've already graduated to fourth density negative or higher, because negative polarity is so difficult to gain. You have to gain it literally by conquering people and enslaving people, which is a lot of work, man. So they're not willing to take the same risks that a positive being is willing to take. Meaning if a positive being gets karmically involved on Earth, well, they can make up for that just by forgiveness and you know, forgiving themselves, forgiving the person and all that. They can make up for that polarity pretty quickly if they want to. A negative being has to go through another cycle of conquering and enslaving people and creating a power structure that they dominate. That's a lot more work. So it's like the treasures that the negative path wins, they don't risk. They don't gamble with them. You know what I mean? Only if there was some really great reason for them to wander, like let's say that they need a certain level of negative polarity to graduate to the fifth density negative, and they've not been able to get it in the fourth. So they're like, look, let me just go back to third density. I'll try to be the most evil, selfish human that's ever lived, gain a bunch of negative polarity, and then I'll graduate to the fifth density. In some rare cases, they'll do that. Otherwise, it's like, yo, I'm not risking that I bump into a guru in that lifetime and become positive, you know, and lose all my negative polarity.
The biggest risk is bumping into a guru.
It can happen, man. That's how they get you.
Do you have a sense? Are you personally like a native third density being that's deciding, or have you wandered in? Do you even know about your own self?
Yeah, it's a good question. So Ross says that there was a lot of wanderers from the 1980s, I believe. There was a huge influx of wanderers. Dolores Cannon also says this. She has a whole book on the new waves of wanderers coming here. So Ross says that there's like 65 million wanderers already on the planet by 1981, because all these souls were incarnating here to try and tip the scales to the positive, which Ross says they actually succeeded in doing. All the higher vibrational souls that incarnated here actually did lift our planet's energy enough to become positively polarized in 2012. So there's a good chance that anyone who's even listening to this conversation right now, you're probably not a native third density soul, although you definitely could be, but chances are just better at this point if we consider how many people on this planet are truly on a spiritual path and want enlightenment and stuff. There's probably like an 80% chance that anyone at that level is a wanderer from fourth or fifth or sixth density. So I think the chances are probably pretty high, being that I'm a spiritual teacher and whatnot, that I'm probably not native third density. I don't know if that's true, and I don't care if it's true. If someone told me that I'm a third density soul, it wouldn't make any difference to me, because it's like we're all of the densities ultimately. Like every version of you already exists right now. There's a sixth density version of you right now in the universe, you know, living as your higher self. And there's a second density version of you living as an animal, you know, 3 million years ago or something. So it's like everything exists simultaneously. You're not more special because you're a sixth density soul right now, you know?
I heard an interesting interview with this guy from Germany he has conversations with what he calls being six, but it's a sixth density sort of complex of awareness. And one interesting thing I wanted to ask you about was that the benefit of an aggressive species like humans. So they're saying, like, right before coming back to seventh density, right before everything is back to wholeness, there's like one last being in sixth density that's negatively polarized, and that has to be resolved and reintegrated somehow. And that this was his explanation of why humanity is important, is because we have this aggressive nature that, if deployed properly, can be defensive. And like, for all the beings in sixth density that could be influenced by the sixth density sort of negative polarization, there needs to be some defense against that, in order to sort of resolve that last bit of negative polarization. Any thoughts on that concept?
Very interesting. I'm not sure I totally understand what he was saying, but Ra does say that early sixth density is the latest, is the farthest that a negative being can polarize. Meaning at a certain point, once a being graduates to sixth density negative, which is extraordinarily hard to do, they may choose to reverse polarity before that sometimes, but they'll run into a sort of brick wall, metaphysically speaking, where they, no matter what they do, no matter how many planets they conquer, they can't gain any more negative polarity. They can't become any more negative than they already are. And Ra calls the negative path the path of that which is not, meaning it's a path of illusion, ultimately. And the illusion is that there is separation. So because it's not based on eternal law, right? It's a distortion of eternal law, then it can't progress forever. There is a limit to it. Think about a shadow. I talked about the shadow analogy earlier. There's only so long that shadow can stretch, right? Depending on where the sun is at. And at a certain point, the shadow can't grow any farther from the object that it's being projected from. That's like the negative path. It will run its course at some point. And that's apparently at the beginning stage of sixth density, just before the soul becomes the higher self, which happens at mid sixth density. And for the David Hawkins nerds listening, like you, Derek, that's about a 50,000 calibration on the scale of consciousness. We become the higher self at that point. And so Ra says there are no negatively polarized higher selves in the universe, to their knowledge, meaning every negative being in the universe has a positively polarized higher self that's bringing them catalysts and guiding them. Because at a certain point at early sixth density, they have to concede, this is the path of illusion. I can't go any farther. The true path is the positive. And then they reverse polarity to the positive.
Every negative polarized being has a positive polarized higher self. That's remarkable.
The universe is amazing, man.
I'm curious, have you experienced any breakthroughs this year?
In terms of
understanding or awareness, or because I know you're actively still studying a lot so that you can teach. I'm just curious if you've had any like aha moments.
Oh man, yeah, this whole year has been a breakthrough in so many ways. I have my notes app on my phone that I'm constantly using to write down any kind of, you know, downloads or realizations I have. And it's so disheveled because I just have so many note apps. I can just scroll forever, just hundreds and hundreds of them. I can open any of them and just read through all the realizations that I was having that day that I wrote it. I'll write, you know, 5 to 10 different paragraphs in each one before I write a new note. I try to make them about certain subjects and whatnot. So it's cool to go back, like, you know, to like last year, some point, click on it and just start reading what I was writing about and read it as, okay, so when I wrote this, it was a, oh my God, this is incredible. I have to write this down. And I'm just getting it in that moment. And I'll read it now. And it's like, yeah, this is obvious. Now, so it's cool to see how we progress in our spiritual intelligence as the things that blow our minds at one point become normal reality to us later down the road.
It's so funny. My friend was asking, she was like, what's the weirdest book recommendation? I was like, I bet a lot of these would be weird to some people, but I don't really see like Autobiography of a Yogi or any of these channeled books that I read this yeah. year. I'm like, yeah, they're all helpful and make a lot of sense, but
subjective.
Yeah. But I still feel like the Castaneda books are the weirdest because they're such a first person narrative of these non-ordinary realities that they, you know, sort of like how this person is being blown away in real time, you know?
Uh-huh. Don Juan.
Yeah. Don Juan is this Mexican shaman that basically it's the same stuff that you're teaching, but he teaches it experientially. So okay. He's not using words. He's just curating sometimes over many years, certain lessons that the person goes through by he like assigns a series of tasks for the person to do, but the lesson is not apparent until much, much later, which
that's
is
fascinating.
Yeah. Really phenomenal.
I'm going to get into this for sure.
Yeah. So I reread these books. The first four are the sort of, I know to be the actual story of the apprentice. So I reread all of them this year. And it's like whole new set of ahas from this. The main concept that he's talking about is the tonal and the nahual, which is like, you should have awareness of your lower self, which is the tonal, and your higher self, the nahual, at the same time. Like, and only when you have that awareness of like, so the tonal is like what you perceive as the material world.
Yeah.
And also the tricks that the tonal uses to convince you of its, you know, fact. So a lot of the experiences that he's curating are things that are meant to blow his mind so that he realizes that's just a construct.
Very interesting, because as you're saying that, a passage from the Law of One's coming to mind where Ra says the same exact thing, that we have to have equal awareness of ourself as the eternal, as the creator, absolutely perfect and eternal, and our relative human self that's on this journey of evolution to heal and evolve, and that it's the balanced awareness of both that leads us to essentially enlightenment. I'll read it right here. It's from section 57. Ra says, the seeker seeks the one. This one is to be sought by the balanced and self-accepting self, aware both of its apparent distortions and its total perfection. Resting in this balanced awareness, the entity then opens the self to the universe which it is. The light energy of all things may then be attracted by this intense seeking, and wherever the inner seeking meets the attracted cosmic prana, realization of the one takes place. Beautiful passage.
Mm. I love that you just had that up and ready to go.
I just pulled it up real quick on Law of One. So yeah, I love that, man.
Let's see. There's a bunch of... Let me go back. I'm going to look through my notes to see what did I get your comments.
What's next about on the docket?
Do you do any predictions? Like, I know a lot of people this time of year are doing sort of tuning in to 2023 with either like clairvoyance or like picking up frequency or whatever they may be. Do you do anything like that?
No, I don't do any kind of psychic work in that regard, at least not now. I definitely have my own kind of predictions and assumptions of where I see things going based on where things are now. And I've heard a lot of really interesting, you know, whether it's astrological predictions or psychic predictions, prophecies and whatnot, they all kind of seem to converge on the same things, which is like essentially the, I think it's the Uranus energy of like revolt and renewing and what's the word that Uranus is most associated with? Like revolution, I think.
Mm.
that we're heading into a time of extreme upheaval on this planet where all the shadows are manifesting it at the same time, so we can kind of collectively vomit them out and get rid of them. And so there's going to be a lot of, you know, probably more war, a lot of like public dissension and overthrowing of the power structures that be, which obviously needs to happen at some point. If humanity is going to evolve into an enlightened civilization, we have to create a completely new system, whether that means we violently overthrow the one we have now, or if it's a peaceful dissolution of just people deciding to stop participating in that system, and just we create our own new systems and the new just outgrows the old. I hope it goes that way. But it may be a bit of a mix of the two. So who knows?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, it's better to burn out or fade away. That rock and roll lyric. So like, would an old system be able to fade away? And, you know, just like, hey, remember when we used to use US dollars? Like, whatever happened to those? You know, like, I feel like it would be much more like kicking and clawing on its way out kind of thing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. If and when the old system dies, it will die kicking and screaming the whole way. But that will be the system's own doing to themselves if they make it a painful death process, right? It wouldn't be on our end of things, meaning those of us who have recognized the old system was based on corruption and power and service to self. And we just say, okay, I'm a being of love. I'm a being of service to others. So I just can't participate in that system anymore because it doesn't serve others, right? And we just walk away from it. We start doing something over here, a new system of money or currency or whatever. The old system will just slowly lose power over decades and decades, such that it won't even be recognized until it's halfway through its death. You know, it can happen that gradually. Or it could be this kind of huge overthrow where, like, we might actually see this happen, right, in 2023 and beyond, where the central banking systems that secretly run the planet are trying to impose this digital currency on everyone. And they already woke up so many people from the COVID stuff that's like, no, we see who you people are. We see the games you play. We're not participating anymore. Whatever you say for us to do, we're doing the opposite. So you want us to use a digital currency? Nope, not interested. A huge segment of the planet is definitely going to do that, right? Myself included. So what's that going to look like? If they're going to try to force it on that 50, 60% of humanity that refuses to participate, well, then there's going to be some kind of clash that has to happen, right? Where whether it's through an actual type of civil war or military type of conflict, it's not going to end well if that's what the powers that be choose to do. But I think from my perception of things now, they kind of know they're on a ticking clock. I think they understand that their time is running short in terms of keeping the power structures they have in place. They know that humanity is awakening. And I think actually COVID was kind of their test run of, let's kind of test the planet out to see how controllable they still are. Let's do the full pandemic stuff, force them to lock themselves indoors, strap a mask over their face, take whatever injection we tell you to take, and all the other stuff. And I don't think they expected the amount of resistance they got. I think that they were very disappointed in the amount of people that resisted. And so that kind of woke them up to, okay, if we're going to pull this Agenda 2030 Great Reset thing off, we got to go all systems blast right now, because these people are waking up to us and they're pushing back pretty hard. So I think for that reason, that's where they seem to be to me. They're very aware of the collective consciousness and they work based on that relationship. So I think we're going to see a desperation attempt probably to force digital currency and social credit and ESG. And the question is, how will humanity respond to that enforcement? Will we come up with a more enlightened approach of transcending it, or will it be the fight's on type of approach? And if it's the latter, then our evolution will take a little bit longer, right? Because we're going to have to overcome the karma of that for a while. But to me, it's inevitable that the old system is perishing and will perish at some point.
Could you sort of characterize more broadly, like, if positively polarized people are in conflict with negatively polarized people in third density, like how would that typically play out?
Yeah, so the positive polarity only polarizes by honoring and protecting free will. So a positively polarized being would never fight a negative and like try to take them down or whatever. They would say, hey, if you want to make your system of negativity, I honor that as an equal expression of the creator, but I just can't participate in it, right? Because I'm not negative, I'm positive. So I'm going to go over here and let you have your free will, and I'm going to create a system that's based on unity and love. And that's how the positive fights, so to speak, the negative, is that it, one, depolarizes the negative by not resisting it. Because as we said earlier, the negative fully depends on taking power from people. And one of the ways you give power to the negative is you fight it like an enemy, right? If I make you an enemy, I'm giving you a lot of power in my mind. You really are a strong, dangerous, and scary threat to me. So I'm going to do everything I can to fight you. Well, that's how they gain power over you, right? Mm-hmm. The positive depolarizes them by saying, oh, you're nothing but God. I have no fear of you. You're one with me, my brother. I love you. It's like, oh, well, then what can you do now to control that person? They're not playing the game with you, right? So it's like, I'm not participating with you, but I also don't see you as an enemy or a threat at all. And so it just takes all the wind out of the sails for the negative path.
Have you heard about the story of Maldek? I recently heard sort of from this person put together from sort of many different sources, including I think some books from maybe Isaiah was the one from the Bible where like this stuff was happening. But so the story is that this planet, which used to be the fifth planet in between Mars and Jupiter,
yes,
blew itself up due to conflict, but that the people, the beings that initiated that destruction believed they were positively polarized, but they weren't. So is that, how could you arrive in a situation like that? Convince yourself that you're positively polarized, but actually negative polarized. And just for people that don't know the story, you can probably look it up, but that's the asteroid belt. So the debris from this exploded mm-hmm. planet is the asteroid belt. And some of those plagues, some of those biblical plagues were like radiation bearing meteoric storms, like, you know, radiation dust basically settling on the people of those eras, yeah. As I understand it.
Well, I think Maldek was sort of another version of what's happening on Earth right now, in that there is a great mixture of positive and negative. And as we know, even in chemistry, if there's a big mixture of those two charges, it can create, you know, explosions and chaos can result. Harmony only can happen from a single polarity at a time, right? So Maldek was apparently like Earth in that there was positively polarized beings there that wanted it to be a positive planet. But there was a lot of power structures on that planet of negative beings as well. And I would imagine it was probably a planet like ours where certain elites on that planet had figured out how to make monopolies and control entire systems and gather all the resources to themselves. And that's when you get this really unhealthy balance like we see on our planet. It's exactly like cancer, right? Cancer happens when a cell is no longer able to communicate to the cells around it. It loses its pH balance from alkaline and acid, and it goes super acidic. But at a certain point of acidity, it will lose electrical conductivity and it will wall itself off because now it doesn't know where it is anymore. And then every cell that comes into its energy field is absorbed into that acidity and starts walling off with it. And so the tumor keeps consuming all the cells around it in its relentless desire to grow, right? That's what the negative path basically is. It's like a cancerous tumor that it has no other purpose of existence but to keep gaining power. There's no end goal in mind. There's no real purpose for it other than more power. So it doesn't have any kind of self-correcting built-in mechanism. It will keep going until it destroys everything in its path, even the planet that it's on. So like there are people in positions of power right now that would absolutely, if they could, blow up the planet and wipe it from existence before they would let it become positive and lose all their power, right? That's just where they are. And I bet you anything that that's what happened on Maldek, that the beings that were in great power there, either there was a war or a conflict of an attempted takeover and they just ended up nuking themselves to oblivion, or if the people in power themselves just decided to do it. Clearly, the raw material says the same thing, that the planet blew itself up. So one of those two things had to happen, right?
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. That's such a great your description of cancer. And it just reminded me right away of capitalism's sort of incessant need for growth.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? I was reading another one of the books that made a big impression on me this year was Braiding Sweetgrass. And it's by this Native American woman who's also a biologist. And she's talking about how in a lot of Native American languages, the word person extends to all things. So like a tree is a person and a rock is a person, and it frames reality differently, right? When you're like, oh, hello, Mr. Tree, or hello, Mr. Rock. And you sort of see them as equals, not something to be like conquered or taken or, you know, colonized or, you know, right. the common term. But it was such a fascinating, you're just realizing like, we're bound by this language, even that sort of forces us to think. It sort of puts us in a negative polarity lens almost, because because we can't even think about what it means to be equal to certain things.
Very true, man. And to that end, that's one of the two main control mechanisms of the negative polarity is language and money or currency. I can't imagine what a third one would be, just because those two encompass every aspect of existence in that sense. But on our planet, at least, what we've seen is that those are really the only two control mechanisms of the negative polarity to create enslavement, is either by controlling the currency, the means of commerce and exchange and value on the planet, and or controlling the language, right? And we've seen a very systematic effort to do both of those things here in the States for the last 150 or so years, this kind of systematic controlling of language and weaponizing language to divide people. We see it now in mainstream media, right? Like constantly, relentlessly, this almost psychopathic obsession with labeling everything and labeling people, racist, transphobe, homophobe, this phobe, that phobe. It's like the second you see someone who even seems to have, right, a difference of opinion, you have to slap a label on them so you can control them. That's the tactic of the negative path. Create a label, a certain part of language that says, you know, this thing we all agree is evil, heinous, horrible, to be loathed, to be despised, no good, no redemption in it. And then all I have to do once I've created this consensus reality through this word is just, I just now apply that word to whatever I disagree with and want to control. So whoever's opposing me, they're that horrible label we just all agreed on. And it works on people that have a lower level of spiritual intelligence. They fall for that trap. And they live in this matrix world of labels, right? That's how the negative path controls people in one sense, is by creating a fake world out of words that you think you're living in. And you never actually engage with reality. You never actually see that person for who they really are. You only see the label you've projected onto them. It's a very powerful control device. You know, going back to MKUltra and the CIA experiments, this is what they were experimenting on, right? To what end can we weaponize language to make people our mind puppets? And they found out, to a great end, we can do that.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great analogy, controlling people with language. I think I saw you did a video about legal fiction and sort of weaponizing of the legal code. Mm-hmm. And I realized the same thing last year when there's so much in the it's like all the maritime law, which sort of seeps its way into everything, sort of citizenship and
water words.
Yeah, it's, it blew me away when I sort of had it explained.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what they've done here in the States and other countries like Canada and Australia and England. Anywhere where there's common law, this has been the main approach that the negative path on this planet has chosen to overcome the very well-built common law system that mankind created long ago to prevent this kind of enslavement from happening. Basically, what has happened is that there's two law systems. One is law, one is legal, and they exist side by side, but you're only ever in one or the other. And one of them is common law, the law for mankind, based on biblical principles, based on, you know, godly truth, right? That all men are created equal. We are all endowed with inalienable rights, life of liberty, life to pursue, right to pursue happiness. And no one has any more value than anyone else. So nobody can be a lord over someone, can enslave someone. That's all unlawful. But under contract law, which is maritime admiralty law, you know, if you and I want to get into a contract where I say that you're my master and I'm your debt slave, we have all the right to do that because it's between us. It's a contract, right? We just can't force everyone else to be under that contract, right? It's a private thing. Well, so what they did was they slowly tricked everyone into believing that we live under contract law, maritime law, that that's the real law system. And common law, which is also called equity law, is beneath that and subject to that. And it only is if you're under a contract. So their thing is, how do we get everybody under a contract so that now we can apply contract law to them? And they did that through the birth certificate in 1913, I think, when that law was instituted and everybody had to be registered with the state at birth. Your birth certificate is like your car's title. Whoever owns the title to the car really owns the car. When you're born, they create a title for you called a birth certificate, where they put your name in all capital letters, and then your mom signs on the dotted line, and she's just thinking that she's saying, yes, this person was born, they're under this family name, here's their record of birth, and now that they're a recorded citizen. Unfortunately, she's been deceived by the system into signing her child over as property and giving the title to the government to say, now this is our asset, this person belongs to us under contract. So now they're under our jurisdiction. They're not under common law anymore. So we're not taught that this happened. We're taken through public school where we're never taught what law is or what the legal system, how it works, none of it. So it's like we're sort of being told that we're playing checkers, but we're actually playing chess and we have no idea we're playing chess. The people who are in power know we're playing chess and they know the rules of chess very well. Not only do we not know we're playing chess, we don't even know how to play chess, right? Even if we knew we were really playing chess, we still wouldn't know how to win. That's how disadvantaged they've made it, so that we're playing by the wrong rule set and we don't even know we're playing by the wrong rule set. So they're basically our overlords and our debt slave owners, right? So what's happening now is that people have been waking up to this fact by going back to the Constitution and the founding fathers' laws and principles and saying, wait a minute, they made a system so that there's no involuntary slavery. And why are we all slaves to the IRS and slaves to the government? Well, it's because they created a second citizenship called the U.S. citizenship, which is actually the word citizen literally means city, means municipal, C-I-T-I, it means municipal. And then Zen means a servant of. In Latin. So citizen literally means a municipal servant. So if you're a US citizen, you are a employee of the government. You work for them. You're under contract with them through your birth certificate, through your social security card. You've signed on the dotted line. Yes, I am your slave. You are my master and I will do your bidding. I will follow your laws, your procedures, your codes, and your statutes, right? Now, under common law, just the fact that you exist means you're the highest in the land, means nobody can tell you what to do. The only way you can be controlled is if you do harm to somebody. And then that person takes you to court and a a court of your peers and a jury decides, yep, you really did that person harm. So now you have to pay them whatever sum of money or whatever. That's the only way a living man or a living woman, not under a contract law, can have harm done to them, right? Every crime has to have a victim in common law. There's no such thing as a crime where nobody was injured. Under contract law, you can simply violate a policy and they call that a crime and they'll throw you in jail and they'll fine you thousands of dollars for it, right? Because you're under a contractual relationship with them and you don't even know it. So yeah, it's a whole amazing rabbit hole that we could go much deeper into if we want, but that's kind of the basics of how it all works.
And did you extract yourself from that, from all those contracts? Have you been able to do that?
So the tricky thing is that a lot of this is understanding what's really happening, which takes a little bit of time to grasp. You have to go down the rabbit hole for a while, right? Before you understand how the matrix works. And so my understanding of all this has evolved a lot. Whereas when I first got into this understanding, yeah, I was doing the paperwork and I was rescinding my voter. I terminated my voter registration. I terminated my U.S. citizenship and sent all these documents in and had them notarized and signed and affidavits. But then I started to realize, wait a minute, I'm not in the system. I've never been in the system. So I can't even leave the system. My legal fiction is in the system, right? The all capitals names, corporation that they made out of my name at birth, that's what's in the system. And it'll always be in the system because the system created it. One of the maxims of law says that which one creates, one controls. So I didn't make the legal fiction. They made the legal fiction. They've just duped me into constantly representing the legal fiction without knowing it. For example, you know, when we saw Facebook go to court, we see Mark Zuckerberg gets up and has to testify for Facebook and defend Facebook and speak on Facebook's behalf, right? That's because a corporation is a dead entity. It doesn't exist, right? A corporation can never run itself. It needs a living man or woman to represent it, yeah? That's what the president of a company does or the CEO of a corporation does. The word corporation literally is the two words corpse and oration. Corpse means dead, right? Oration means speak. So a corporation means dead speak. The dead speaking is what it means. So it's a non-living fictional entity that is given the appearance of existence through a living person who speaks for that organization, right? It's like a zombie. It has to feed off of the lifeblood of a living person to live. So when you get summoned into court, just look at that word, right? Summoned. What gets summoned? You don't summon the living, right? You summon the dead in a satanic ritual or a black magic ritual. You summon spirits from the dead, right? So they summon you to court because they're summoning your dead entity, not you. They can't call you a living man into court unless you've done harm to somebody and someone is testifying against you in open court, right? You can't just like be called into court by the IRS and be told you have to pay money. Like, sorry, who are you? I don't know you. I've never entered a contract with you. I don't owe you anything. Well, but my legal fiction does, because my legal fiction's under contract with them. So they'll summon your corporation into court, but because it has your all capitals names, you think it's you, right? So you're just like in spirituality, you're identified with the wrong self, with the false self. And as long as you're falsely identified with this fictional self, this fictional ego, we might say, they can control you through that fictional ego. So you go to court and they say, is Aaron Scott Abke present? And they're referring to my all capitals name, fiction. And I think it's me. So I say, yes, Your Honor, present. So now I'm acting like the president of Aaron Abke Inc., right? Aaron Abke Corporation. I'm the president of Aaron Abke Corporation speaking on its behalf. Mm-hmm. Just like Mark Zuckerberg has to speak on behalf of Facebook. Mr. Facebook can't walk into court and speak for itself. It doesn't exist, right? Neither can your legal fiction walk into court and represent itself without you, the living man or woman, walking in and speaking for it. So they have to trick you into doing that by keeping this whole game a disguise. You don't ever know it exists. You don't know you have a legal fiction. You don't know your birth certificate is actually the title of property for you. And so you just think it's the person that they're talking to, the living man, when it's not, right? They don't have any jurisdiction over the living man unless they trick you into being the fiction.
So you did all the paperwork and whatnot, but now it's like what you're saying is it's like the healing thing. Like you just have to realize that you were never part of the system in the first place. So, but how do you, like, what's your approach to interacting with it at this point?
Yeah. Well, it's very nuanced, right? Because the vast majority of people, especially public servants, don't know that this is going on. They don't understand the matrix that they're serving and working in. They don't understand the legal fiction. So like the approach of trying to cram this down a police officer's throat when they pull you over is not a good approach because they'll think you're crazy or they'll think you're a sovereign citizen and they'll just probably try to arrest you or something. So the mode of operation is very much what Jesus said, be as wise as serpents, but as innocent as doves. So you always come in peace. You always come to be an honor and do what's right. And this is the way the positive path, the light defeats the darkness, is that what the darkness does is they steal your light without you knowing it. Once the light wakes up and realizes, oh, the darkness is stealing my light and using it against me. So now all I have to do is stand on the light, stand on the truth. So what we do in law is you know, the passage where Jesus says, agree with your adversary quickly before he takes you into court and makes you go before the judge who will cast you into prison or whatever. Jesus actually taught this strategy, agree with your adversary quickly. And the way we do that is what we call conditional acceptance. So anyone who accuses me of owing them a debt or violating a legal code, I conditionally accept their offer right away so that I'm not in conflict with them. I'm not opposing them. I'm saying, hey, I want to work this out in honor with you. So I'll accept these charges if you can verify that there really is a debt to be paid. So what you do is you put the truth back in the camp of illusion and you say, hey, can you verify that this is true? And that's where the power is, because they can't, because their system is built on fraud. For example, debt. All debt is fraud. All debt is basically theft, where they steal from your Social Security account. Like most people know this, right? When banks loan you money, they're not actually giving you their money. Like they're not saying, hey, I got $100 in my bank account, in my piggy bank. Why don't you borrow it, buddy, and do what you want with it, and then just give it back to me 2 years from now. That's not what banks do. Banks never, ever, ever loan anything of their own. They don't give you any money that was theirs. So they don't put any asset in the equation. And under common law, you can't be in debt to someone if they didn't give you something of their own, right? There has to be an equal exchange of value. So what banks do is they tap into your Social Security trust, which has way more money in it than you think it does. You think it only has the money you're putting into it? The Federal Reserve assigns everyone a dollar value at birth based on how much value you'll produce in your life. Because think about it, right? We think that gold, let's say, is like the highest asset that exists because gold is worth a lot. Well, what's more valuable than gold? If you think about it, you have to say, well, human life, right? Human life is by far the most valuable thing in existence. Because look, yeah, gold is worth a lot of money, but gold can't start a business. Gold can't produce a product. Gold can't enter a business contract. Gold can't do anything. It can't even mine gold. Exactly. So you're like, oh, wow, actually, we're all the value that exists. Like you and I, your living existence on this planet is inherently extremely valuable. Because you consume products, you make the stock market run, you make the economy run. Everything depends on humans, right? Where's the economy if every human is disappeared from the planet tomorrow? What use does money serve if there's no people? None. So you and I are all the value that really exists. And guess what? The Federal Reserve knows that. So what they do is they assign every person, just like you would assign a brick of gold. Oh, this brick of gold is worth $20,000. They assign you a dollar value. And I believe in the 1970s, it was like $1 million is where it starts. In the 90s, it was raised to like 5 million. And I think now it's well over $10 million. Like just by virtue of being born, they say you're worth at least $10 million. All the money you'll ever make in your life, all the business contracts you'll enter, every cent, right, that will go through you in your entire existence, the Federal Reserve says that all belongs to us because we own them now. We have their title, their birth certificate. We have superior title to them. So that's why they assign you a value and they print money based on however much value they've, the collateral that they have with people, with humans. So by the time you're in your 30s, your Social Security trust account has been bonded and traded on the stock market thousands of times, like a stock. People like stocks on the stock market. And if you don't believe me, you can go to a website right now, if you're listening, called gmeiutility.com, maybe .org, let me double check. And there's a search bar where you can enter your social security number with the dashes. So 3 numbers -2 numbers -4 numbers. And it will pull up all the companies that have traded your social security account, your bond, since you've been alive. And the last time I checked, mine had been traded over 47,000 times. And you can actually see the exact companies trading it. And what's funny is almost all of them are Chinese companies, like 70% of them.
Really?
Yep. So they're bonding you and trading you on the stock market because you're so valuable, right? And if you get a job, if you get a pay raise, if you make a lot of money, your stock, it's like when a stock goes up, right? When a business earns a bunch of money, their stock value goes up and people trade it. Well, when you start having money coming into your bank account, the system knows that and they say, hey, this person's making a lot of money. And so people start trading your account more and more. And so this is all happening while you're none the wiser. So all that a bank does when you ask for a loan is they take it out of your trust and they loan you your own money that belongs to you from birth, right? It's your value that they're trading. And then they make you pay them back for the money that they loaned you and with interest. So they're like triple dipping you without you even knowing it.
Oh, man. that's crazy. Man, so you can see yourself being traded. That's wild.
Yeah. So
where does this all lead? What do we do with this information?
Yeah, good question. First of all, we wake up to it and we start spreading awareness of it. If each one of us could just do this one thing, which is to understand the real system in the world, which is we've all been tricked into living under Admiralty Maritime Law, contract law. We've all been tricked into entering a contract with the government that none of us would ever consent to if we knew it. Then we have to begin opting out of that system, which doing paperwork is helpful. You know, you can send affidavits of repudiation in. One of the maxims of law, by the way, says truth is expressed in the form of an unrebutted affidavit. An affidavit is like a statement of truth under penalty of perjury. So you write a document that says, I name hereby attest under penalty of perjury that I am not a U.S. citizen. I am an American state national. So you change your citizenship and then you send it in to the president and the attorney general and whoever else you want. You have it notarized first. You send it in. And then after 21 days, if nobody responds and says, we disagree that you aren't a U.S. citizen, we say that you are. If they don't send you an affidavit in return to rebut yours, your affidavit stands as fact under law. It can be used as a court document where you said, hey, I notified the president, the attorney general, the secretary of state on March 5th last year that I'm not a U.S. citizen. So I have documented proof that I have opted out of my contracts. So from that point forward, I can't be obligated to pay the IRS taxes, to do any of this stuff that I have to do when I'm a U.S. citizen. What they did was they tricked everyone into giving up a superior citizenship or status, let's say, for an inferior status. When the United States of America was founded, the first citizenship, sorry, I shouldn't use that word, the first status was the American state national, because it was a country of a bunch of states that have come together to say, we'll kind of do a country together, but we're sort of independent countries, right? California, Nevada, Utah, and so forth. So every American person was a state national of their state first. So a Texan, an Oklahoman, a Californian, an Iowan, on and on. You were a citizen of your state. But then in 1913 and going forward, the United States said, well, we got to get everyone under contract. And as American state nationals, they have all the power, because remember, that which one creates, one controls. American state nationals created the government. The founding fathers were American state nationals, and they wrote the documents, right? So American state nationals control the government. We have the right and the power as state nationals to depose and get rid of our government anytime we want. That was what the founding fathers intended. If you think the government's getting corrupt, you can tear them down tonight and make a new one. The government exists to serve the people. They're public servants. What do we have now? We have this big brother overlord organization that dominates and dictates every aspect of human life to its citizens, like we're their cattle, their property. They tell us what to do. And it's always was intended to be the opposite. So to repudiate the US citizenship, I think, is the most important thing we can do. Just get some kind of record, right? There's so many ways to do this. And there's many teachers showing how to do this. I've done it through affidavits and taking power of attorney over the legal fiction and things like that. But get a document notarized, send it in, an affidavit that says, I'm not a US citizen. I'm an American state national. And then nobody can ever tell you that you're not. Because one of the other maxims of law is the right of self-determination. That's in our Constitution. Everyone has the right to say, this is who I am. I can be whatever citizenship I want. Nobody can force me to be a certain kind of citizen, right? But if you don't know who you are, you can't express who you are, and the system will make you their slave. So it's not just about your paperwork. Paperwork is helpful and it plays a part, but it's really about your knowledge. Do you know who you are, and can you express who you are? Because your rights don't exist if you can't express your rights. That's a maxim of law. If you don't know your rights and you don't express them on your own behalf, nobody's going to come along and help you express your rights for you. You know what I mean? They're going to take full advantage of your ignorance. So you have to know who you are. You have to know what your rights are and how to express them. That's where the real magic happens, where people can go into court and say, hey, just notifying the court, this is who I am. Here's my documents to prove it. I'm just here to settle this matter today. I'm not this legal fiction. I am the executor of this estate. So you can just go ahead and discharge this account. People are doing this now that they have the knowledge to express it in the right ways. And in the legal system, the language is so important, because they use words, again, as weapons, right? If you use words the wrong way, you're actually entering verbal contracts sometimes without knowing it. One example is getting pulled over by a police officer, or even when you go to court, whenever an authoritative figure asks you, do you understand? If you say, yes, I understand, that's actually a legalese term, which means to stand under someone. So you're actually saying, yes, I stand under you, meaning you have more legal authority than me. I'm underneath you, legally speaking. You've just entered a verbal contract with them. So the knowledge is super, super important in this stuff.
Wow. And I'm just seeing the parallels to so many of the other things you talk about of, you know, spiritual development, and is like going perfectly hand in hand with like just understanding the structures, the 3D structures here.
They're perfect fractals of each other. They really are.
Aaron, it's always, I learned so much from you. I mean, this is obviously why lots of other people do as well, but, yeah, it's really great having you on and using your way with words. Gifted teacher.
Gifted orator, huh?
Gifted orator, yeah. There you go.
Well, thank you, man. It's a pleasure to chat with you. And I always appreciate how well thought out your questions are. It makes it a really fun conversation.
Appreciate that. Is there anywhere you would like to point people, direct people's attention?
Yeah, always to my YouTube channel if you want to get into any of my content, youtube.com/AaronApke. And then if you want to look at any of the programs I offer, you can always go to AaronApke.com to my website.
Beautiful. All right, buddy. Well, have a great Christmas. Happy New Year. And
likewise, man.
See you next time.
Talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye.